You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors.
It's Monday, February 15th, 2010. A friend of mine told me I need to announce the year now that this show's been on the air a couple years, so I'm going to start doing that. Thanks, Michelle. Today in Burlington, the sun rose at 6:53 a.m. and is due to set at 5:20 p.m., giving us 20 more minutes of daylight than we had last Monday, which is very exciting. So today is President's Day, and on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview with Gary Kowalski, senior minister to the First Unitarian Universalist Society in Burlington, and the author of several best-selling books on animals, nature, history, and spirituality. A graduate of Harvard College and the Harvard Divinity School, Gary Kowalski published his latest book, Revolutionary Spirits, The Enlightened Faith of America's Founding Fathers, in 2008. He writes a blog on how the founders viewed issues affecting faith and public life at revolutionaryspirits.blogspot.com. His other books include The Souls of Animals, Goodbye Friend, Healing Wisdom for Anyone Who Has Ever Lost a Pet, Science and the Search for God, and The Bible According to Noah, Theology as if Animals Mattered. His work has been translated into German, French, Spanish, Japanese, Chinese, and Czech, and has been voted Reader's Favorites by the Quality Paperback Book Club. Revolutionary Spirits is due to come out in paperback this spring, and it seemed like a good selection for President's Day. When I spoke to Gary Kowalski last week, I asked him to describe his path both to the ministry and to writing.
I grew up in Oklahoma, and I was a member of the All Souls Unitarian Church in the middle of the Bible Belt. Unitarianism is a bastion of liberalism, and Oklahoma is a fortress of reaction in politics and religion. So I grew up in a somewhat countercultural environment, at least by the standards of the South. You know, the Unitarian Church at that time, that was where progressive things were happening. I was a child in the 60s. That was my coming of age experience. So that was where people were working for civil rights and open housing and questioning the war and so forth. I guess those values and those viewpoints must have rubbed off, stuck with me. Going into ministry wasn't a lifelong dream or anything. In fact, I think I still don't know if I'm suited for it or not after 28 years, but I've managed so far.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderfully privileged profession in that as a clergy person, You're really permitted to ponder the big questions of existence. Why are we here? What's our purpose? How ought we to treat each other? What kinds of standards should we aspire to in our community? And, you know, you can't really do that in academia or business, even in teaching and education. There's only so far you can go. It's this wonderful opportunity to think, to reflect about these ultimate issues. And I guess that's, you know, that's what lies behind my writing, too. It's enabled me to branch out in directions that my imagination suggests. So I've written several volumes about animals and spirituality and the human non-human bond and how we grieve and heal after the loss of a pet. My recent book, Revolutionary Spirits, is somewhat new territory for me. Although I studied history in college at Harvard, I wasn't especially focused on the revolutionary period or the 18th century. So this was a great learning experience. And where else except in ministry would you have the time to write books as part of your job? It's just a great opportunity.
Yeah.
Do you write even when you don't have a specific project in the works?
Well, of course, you know, I'm always writing sermons.
Oh, sure.
Every week. Well, back in the colonial days and after, sermons were a valid literary genre. No one really looks on them as such now, but they're a kind of performance art. You do it each week and then you move on. So I'm always writing sermons, and in the past couple of years I've started blogging also. You never know what's going to turn into a book. In fact, many of my volumes have grown out of sermons, like Science and the Search for God. I mean, the chapters there have been expanded, revised, retouched, but most of them grew out of sermons I delivered over the course of 20 years about where we find meaning in a universe that's 13 billion years old and unimaginably vast and old. Is there anything of human significance here?
Yeah.
So I guess I'm always potentially writing a book.
Do you keep all of your sermons?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
So I've always wondered that, because that must be, you must have a fantastic number of sermons collected.
Well, probably 500 or 600, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite something.
Uh-huh.
Revolutionary Spirits was published in 2008 and is due to come out as a paperback soon, correct?
It'll be out in paperback in May or June, okay. I think, yeah.
Within the book, you associate the founder's desires for political and religious independence.
Yes.
We've always learned that early American settlers were escaping religious persecution, and this book seems to take that truth and lay it out in a really interesting way, sort of showing how the founders were affected by religion and how it affected their pursuit of this cause.
Well, I think they certainly were affected by religious persecution and religious warfare, not all of them directly. The background that the founders and framers were working against was the just incredible religious bloodbath that had taken place in Europe in the previous century. There was the 30 Years' War. It was really the first world war. Practically every country in Europe was involved, and it was basically the Protestant Union and the Catholic League and everybody against the Jews. The lines were drawn in a very sectarian fashion. And historians, they can't get precise figures on the casualties, the death toll, but they think that there were probably more people perished in these religious wars than in any subsequent conflict up to World War I. When the population of Europe was vastly increased, and when you had modern munitions and poison gas to kill people in greater numbers. Back then they were doing it with blunderbusses and pikes, you know, just terrible. So you look at the casualty figures in the villages and towns, there's like 20, 30, 40, 50% casualties, just a decimation. All in the name of God, all in the name of our glorious religion. So the founders of this country were determined that that kind of conflict would not be repeated here in the New World. And I think that's why they were so insistent on the separation of church and state. One of the reasons that Europe today is such a secular part of the world. Nobody goes to church in Great Britain or in the Netherlands. These cathedrals, they're empty. They're museums or mausoleums. Mm-hmm. It's because people still are living with the legacy of those bad old days when religion became such a destructive force in human society. The United States, in contrast, is not only the most religiously diverse country on the planet, it's also one of the most devout. You know, people are involved in faith communities here. Religion plays a role in private life and in public life, both. But people of differing faiths have managed to coexist and to cooperate for the most part here because we have this separation of church and state. Okay. It was a wonderful invention.
What's your take on the headlines, let's say every year at the holidays, when there will be a headline about, you know, whether or not the city of Burlington should be involved in the lighting of the menorah, or whether or not In God We Trust should be on our currency, and
yes.
You know, these sorts of...
Yes, well, you know, the In God We Trust didn't go on the currency until the 1950s. That's when it was adopted as our national motto. Of course, the original motto of the United States was E Pluribus Unum, out of many one, which spoke to the spiritual variety, the diversity of the landscape. In God We Trust replaced that in the 1950s, which was this era of paranoia about atheistic communism, and that was the time we also added Under God to the Pledge of Allegiance, and Congress passed a resolution instituting the National Day of Prayer, which was taken over by Christian evangelicals, not really a national day at all, but a Christian evangelical day to wrap themselves in the flag and hoist their rhetoric about this being a Christian nation, and so forth. So those types of questions, do religious mottos belong on the coin? Should we have a national day of prayer? Should we have a Christmas tree on the public common? You know, those are still hotly debated. And there's not any bright and clear line. The founders themselves were unclear about this at times. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, he regarded one of his great achievements of his lifetime as passing the Virginia Statutes for Religious Freedom, which essentially disestablished the Anglican Church in Virginia. But Jefferson was also appointed to a commission to design a great seal for the United States. And his suggestion for a design for the Great Seal would have had Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt with an inscription that read, "Disobedience to tyrants is obedience to God." So, you know...
kind of a mixed message.
it was a mixed message. And Jefferson also took his own daughters to religious services, which were held in the halls of Congress at that time. He didn't see any conflict about that. But the man that I follow in these matters is James Madison. He was really the architect of the Constitution, as well as the Bill of Rights, and he tended to take the strictest view about church-state separation. If Madison had had his way, there wouldn't even have been chaplains in the military, mm-hmm. for instance. So he's my guide on these matters, but the founders were of differing opinions right. on just where to draw the line. But they were certainly convinced that there oughtn't to be any national creed or national church or, mm-hmm. or federal religion. They were determined that people ought to be free to practice their own faith in their own way and to follow their conscience without interference of a state authority.
Right. What was your personal inspiration to write this book?
Well, I was infuriated by the constant references in the press. You know, you can't go through a week without some letter to the editor talking about our great Christian nation. It drove me crazy, and I kind of knew that the founders weren't Orthodox Christians, but I didn't know that much about their lives. In fact, most people don't know that much about their lives because their inner spiritual selves, they tended to keep private. They weren't guys who stood up on the political platform and said, "Vote for me, I'm God's candidate." You know, they didn't consider matters of faith to be items to be paraded in front of the electorate. So they were extremely discreet, and also most historians don't really deal with these issues. Even good historians like David McCullough, who wrote the biography of John Adams, you know, he just presents John Adams as kind of being a generic middle-of-the-road Christian, which is really a disservice and distortion to how wonderfully idiosyncratic and unorthodox John Adams really was.
I haven't read that biography. Does he deal with his religious life very much?
Well, not much at all. And this is true of most of these figures. You know, they deal with the diplomatic history and the economics and the politics, but religion takes a back seat, which is really strange in the case of John Adams, because he and Abigail were intensely church-going animals. I mean, they were sitting in church practically every single Sunday.
Right.
So that was important to them, but you wouldn't know about, well, you know, McCullough, for instance, I don't know why. He doesn't even deal with this incident in John Adams' youth as a boy growing up in Braintree. There was actually an inquisition that took place in the Adams homestead. The preacher there had run afoul of the church elders. They considered his sermons to be insufficiently orthodox. He was deviating from the old-fashioned Calvinism. And they took him into the Adams living room and grilled him, interrogated him over points of doctrine. Adams says in his diary that he was so disgusted by the bigotry of it all that he was turned off to ministry. He'd originally been intending to be a minister at that time. He was just starting Harvard at this point. Mm. So that was a formative experience, and McCullough never mentions it.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
This is a quote from the book. "Liberal is a term that has been tarnished, yet it is a label the nation's forefathers wore with pride." And then a little farther down the page, you write, "A liberal is one who cherishes liberty, and freedom was never far from the founders' thoughts. In the political realm, liberalism has been the historic protector and promoter of human rights, carving out a zone of personal autonomy, exempt from government intrusion or oversight. Culturally, liberals prize pluralism. A multiplicity of creeds and customs is the hallmark of a healthy society," which comes back to that E Pluribus Unum motto. To what do you attribute this change in connotation to the word liberal?
Well, partly it's a propaganda campaign by Rush Limbaugh and the zealots of right-wing radio.
And so you think liberal changed that recently?
I think it's become almost a dirty word. Recently. It changed its political connotation. Before that, classic liberalism took a minimalist approach to government to expand the zone of freedom for the individual. And that changed during the New Deal. Franklin Roosevelt's policies were generally considered liberal, and that was a more interventionist point of view. Mm-hmm. The government needed to take a more active hand to ensure equality. There's always been this tension between liberty and equality. So to guarantee that there were not extremes of wealth and poverty, to build a floor so that the least advantaged had some minimal opportunity at a dignified life, the government took an expanded role in the economy, and liberals have become associated with that viewpoint. It's not really a retreat from the libertarian point of view so much as an expanded commitment to social equality, I think. So, but it wasn't the kind of slur word that it's become now. It's really become a term of opprobrium, you know, to be called a liberal. It's like a traitor. You're disloyal, and it's really unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
The Founding Fathers called themselves liberals. This was a label that they embraced, and they were liberals in the classical sense, that they believed that every person who comes into the world does so with a birthright of freedom, and you come into the world surrounded by what I would call a zone of personal autonomy. And in this zone, you have freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of worship, and neither the church nor the state can violate that zone of liberty. In answer to the question that's frequently asked, is America a Christian nation or is it a secular republic? You know, I think the founders would have rejected the premise behind that question, either or. They believed that religion had an important role to play in society, that it could help people to lead better lives, that it could strengthen families, that it could inculcate a sense of civic virtue, that it would lead to stronger bonds between neighbors, and mm-hmm. and as the minister of a church, I've dedicated my life to fostering religious community. I, like the founders, I have to believe that churches and synagogues and temples have a positive role to play. So they believed faith could be a positive force, but they believed that it ought to be exercised primarily in this personal zone, not so much in the public sphere. So faith could have its leavening influence there, but differing religions shouldn't be competing in the public sphere for votes. They shouldn't be forming political parties. They shouldn't be competing for tax dollars, and certainly they shouldn't be competing for military domination. You know, that was what had led to those bad old days of mm-hmm. the 30 Years' War, when religion became such a destructive force. And it's the separation from the private realm of faith and the public realm of politics that I think has enabled America to be relatively blessed for these 200 plus years with a large degree of religious good feeling mm-hmm. in our land. But I see it threatened now. I see it threatened by people who distort the legacy of the founders, who say that they never intended there to be any separation of church and state, and who assert, of course, that their particular interpretation of Christianity and their particular brand of Bible thumping
is
the official dogma of the land. Yes.
Right.
That's a dangerous...
Which is so interesting, because some of these men very specifically countered the teachings of Christianity.
Oh, yeah. Jefferson wrote his own version of the Bible.
Right.
He cut and pasted it so that he eliminated all the miracles, everything he believed was a superstition or just a legend. He tried to go back to what he considered to be the historic teachings of Jesus. He included things like the Good Samaritan and the Sermon on the Mount. Ben Franklin rewrote the Lord's Prayer.
I mean,
these figures were not conventionally devout. They believed there were elements in the Christian tradition that were valuable, that needed to be preserved, but they certainly looked at that tradition with a critical eye.
Yeah. Most of the founders were deists.
Many. Yes.
Many. Not most.
Well, those that I treat in my book, which include Franklin, Washington, Tom Paine, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, I believe you could apply the term deist to all of these in differing degrees. Now, there was never a formal school of deism. Mm-hmm. There were never any list of points or doctrines to which all deists subscribe. The term was used somewhat loosely at the time. In fact, Jefferson even has a letter where he refers to the religion of the ancient Hebrews as deism, by which he meant a kind of ethical monotheism. But deists generally looked upon God as the creator of an orderly universe, who provided both natural laws and moral laws for us to follow. They believed that the essence of faith or religion was to be found in living a virtuous life and contributing one to one's community. And most had some hopes for some type of continued life or immortality beyond the grave, although they differed in this too. George Washington, for instance, never really seemed to believe much in any kind of afterlife. You know, he wrote hundreds of sympathy notes and condolence cards over the course of his career. He never mentions any hope of we'll see each other in the sweet hereafter.
It's not just because he didn't get along with his mother.
No, no.
that's one section of the book I found interesting.
Yes, he really had a strained relationship with his mother, and he wouldn't have enjoyed spending eternity with her, that's for sure. But he had, if anything, a kind of classical notion of the afterlife, kind of a shadowy netherworld of the shades or the spirits, but nothing like a Christian hope of heaven. So they differed in that, but they tended to be deists in that they look towards nature as their primary source of religious inspiration, and to nature's God. I mean, this is the God that is referred to in the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson uses that phrase, nature and nature's God, not the God of the Bible so much. And that becomes confusing for people because the founders do use theistic language. They use the word God, but they're not necessarily referring to the God of Abraham and Isaac, not necessarily the God who the church created, who's divided into three parts, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of their ideas about the afterlife, reminds me of Ben Franklin's own epitaph that he wrote when he was 21.
Yes.
And he wrote, "The body of B. Franklin, printer, like the cover of an old book, its contents wore out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here, food for worms, but the work shall not be lost, for it will, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more elegant edition, revised and corrected by the author."
Franklin had a wonderful, gentle sense of humor, a self-deprecating and ironic viewpoint. It's hard to know sometimes when it's really Franklin speaking and when it's a public persona that he's adopting. And of course, he more and more became a celebrity in his day, and his private identity began to merge and overlap with this public image of the wise sage and elder. His reputation was almost even greater in Europe than in the United States.
So do you think he was playing to the metaphorical camera, as it were? Or?
Well, I do. I think he was creating himself for a public audience. One thing I want to emphasize about the founders is their scientific interests and how they were changed and influenced by the scientific discoveries of their time. All of the figures that I treat in this book were members of what's called the American Philosophical Society. Philosophy in those days was basically a synonym for science, natural philosophy. And the American Philosophical Society was the counterpart to Britain's Royal Society for the Advancement of Science. The Royal Society had as its motto a Latin phrase, nullius in verba, which roughly translated means don't take anybody's word for it, find out for yourself. Mm-hmm. And this was the attitude of these figures. Don't take it on faith. Even if it's written in a book that other people consider holy, you really have to do the research yourself. You have to do the experimentation yourself. So, to answer questions like how old is the earth, for instance, mm-hmm. you couldn't just go back to the book of Genesis and count through all the begats. You couldn't look to Bishop Usher, who calculated it that way and came out that the earth was created in 4004 BC at 9 o'clock in the morning. Jefferson and Madison were both fascinated with this concept of deep time, which had appeared on the scene. The French naturalist Buffon had speculated that the universe wasn't 4,000 years old, that it was probably millions and millions of years old. And he had this idea that the Earth had been created originally through a cosmic collision when a comet smashed into the sun, and that broke off a little chunk of the stellar material, which went spinning around in space. And that glob of molten sun started to cool, and a crust formed on it. And as it cooled some more, the water vapor that was in gaseous form started to condense, and rain began to fall, and water started to collect in the hollows and depressed places of the rocky surface, and the seas were formed. And all this took millions of years. And then with heat acting on naturally occurring compounds there in the shallow seas, the first living organisms came into being. No God necessary. This is a very modern idea. This is not.
I bet he was real popular at church.
Well, he wasn't, but Jefferson and Madison were both fascinated with these concepts. And how would you test this? You know, if your motto was nullius in verba, show me, don't take anybody's word for it. Madison had the idea that you could get some evidence by taking careful measurements. He knew, for instance, that the Earth wasn't a perfect sphere. It's a little smushed at the poles. It's wider at the equator. So it's kind of an ovoid form. And he said, well, if the Earth was originally this hot fireball and it's still hot at the center, then there must be a different degree of radiant heat at the surface, depending on how far the surface of the Earth is now from the Earth's center. So he suggested you take these careful measurements between the equator and the pole, and you could find out that way if it really was hot at the center. Well, he didn't have the time or the instruments to do that, but that was the approach they were taking. John Adams, in his journals, was struggling very much with how Christian dogma could be reconciled with what he was learning in college. At Harvard, his favorite subject as a student was astronomy. And he's writing, you know, how could Newton's God, Herschel's God, have come down to Earth to be incarnated in the form of a first century Jew to be crucified? It just did not make sense to him. So the discovery of deep time and deep space were challenging the Christian revelation in important ways and pushing the founders towards this deistic perspective, looking not to revelation as recorded in the Bible, but looking to revelation as recorded in the heavens and in the great book of nature.
Mm-hmm. I was interested to read about, and you mentioned the Philosophical Society.
Yes.
So many of the founders, certainly that you dealt with in this book, were scholars and inventors.
Yes.
And I'm curious if that is...
They all had an inventive bent. They
right.
were all gadgeteers. Of course, Franklin was a real scientist, and Jefferson also to some degree, but they all carried on their own researches.
Right, and Washington had agricultural interests that he would look to little inventions?
Oh yeah, he was experimenting with soil chemistries
right.
and setting up controlled experiments with different kinds of seeds, using different types of fertilizers to rate the growth of the plants and the grains and the different types of soils. Very interested in engineering and practical inventions of all kinds.
And was Thomas Paine the one who designed the bridge but then never built it?
Tom Paine, it was his great invention. He'd had a home workshop and he'd tinkered with various things, a smokeless candle and so forth. But he built or at least had a design for an iron bridge that would have been able to cross a greater span without the need for intervening supports than other bridges of the time. And Franklin, who was great friends with Paine, encouraged him to take this to England to to show the Royal Society and to France to show the Academy of Sciences there, and he got their support. But unfortunately, as he was trying to sell his bridge idea, the French Revolution broke out,
and he became distracted.
It never came to anything.
He was an interesting man, and you mention in the book, Thomas Paine was the publicist of 1776 who supplied the initial spark that led to independence and war with Britain.
That's right. He came late on the scene. He didn't come over to the United States until 1774. He'd been stirring up trouble in England before then. He was born the son of a corset maker, so he came from extremely modest circumstances. And
his father was a Quaker?
His father was a Quaker. He seemed to have inherited from the Quakers a fierce streak of independence.
Mm-hmm.
The Quakers were not big on government authority. Paine was never a pacifist, but it led him to question the power of kings and other authorities to make decisions. The Quakers believed that each person possessed this inner light that put them on equal footing with one another. So he had that certainty that his ideas, that his dignity was just as good as anyone else's. But when he came to this country, he was delighted with it. He found the United States to be such a contrast to Britain, which was such a class society.
Mm-hmm.
He landed in Philadelphia and quickly found or made his own opportunities as an editor and publicist. And up until this time, despite the Tea Party and despite the conflicts with the mother country, nobody was really thinking seriously about independence until Tom Paine put it in their head. People had been thinking that appeals to King George were the way to go to overcome their differences with Parliament, and Tom Paine said, no, the king is not the solution, the king is part of the problem.
Yeah, right. Now, and you write, mobilizing public opinion proved even more important than mustering cannon. For this work, the publicist had better be inflammatory rather than temperate.
That's right.
And that reminded me of some of our commentators today. You know, the Rush Limbaughs.
They try to be inflammatory.
They're certainly inflammatory. But I'm wondering, was he honest?
Was Tom Paine honest?
Yeah. So he's inflammatory. He has this bringing everybody into a fervor to inspire them, but was he ever prone to be dishonest in trying to get his movement more passion on the part of the people?
I don't think so. I don't think he was ever distorting facts. I mean, you know, on right-wing radio now,
yeah, I think the pundits,
Obama doesn't have a birth certificate.
Right.
He was born in Kenya, and all kinds of crazy talk passes as fact because it's repeated so often. It's the principle of the big lie. You just keep repeating it, and eventually people start, well, there must be something in it. You know, there were publicists in those days who certainly were scandal mongers, and sometimes the scandals had a grain of truth in them. I mean, Jefferson was accused of philandering with Sally Hemings.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a grain of truth in there. They accused Tom Paine of being a drunk and having a bad temper. Well, probably some truth in there. Ad hominem attacks were quite common. There was character assassination that went on. People were really not very polite to one another. We have a lot of calls today for, let's have civil discourse, let's all be polite.
So it wasn't better back then?
Not entirely better, no.
Okay.
It was extremely colorful.
Yeah. Maybe this would be a good time for you to read from the book.
Let me read a section here from a chapter called The Progress of Enlightenment. America's founders were among those who helped stamp out the witch craze once and for all. Readers of the Pennsylvania Gazette on October the 22nd, 1731, for example, were astonished to learn of an incident supposedly witnessed by 300 people in nearby Burlington, New Jersey, where a man and a woman had been indicted on allegations of sorcery. Charges against the two included, quote, making their neighbor's sheep dance in an uncommon manner, and with causing hogs to speak and sing psalms, to the great terror and amazement of the king's good and peaceable subjects in this province. Arrangements were made to put them to the test. In the first ordeal, the two would be weighed in a scale against the Bible. If Holy Writ weighed in against them, it would prove the two were indeed practitioners of the black arts. The second ordeal involved floating. Anxious to vindicate their innocence, the pair readily consented to these conditions, but insisted that two of their accusers accompany them in trial. One at a time, the four were placed on a scale. All were heavier than the books of Moses, the prophets, and apostles put together. Flesh and bones came down with a plump and outweighed that great good book by abundance. No deviltry was evident. This being over, the accusers and the rest of the mob, not satisfied with this experiment, would have the trial by water. Accordingly, a most solemn procession was made to the mill pond, where both accused and accusers were stripped, saving only to the women their shifts, bound hand and foot, and severally placed in the water. One of the accusers, a rather thin man, began to sink while the rest bobbed to the surface. Alarmed to find herself so buoyant, the other accuser asked that she be dunked, believing that the accused had bewitched her to make her so light, and that she would be ducked again 100 times, but she would duck the devil out of her. A sailor in the crowd jumped onto the back of the alleged wizard, meaning to submerge him and drive him to the bottom, but the unfortunate fellow resurfaced like a cork, and being surprised at his own swimming, was not so confident of his innocence as before, but said, "If I'm a witch, it's more than I know." The more thoughtful spectators were skeptical of these shenanigans, reasoning that unless they were mere skin and bones, any person bound and thrown in a body of water would swim till their breath was gone and their lungs filled with water. However, a larger number present believed the women's shifts and garters helped them float and determined they should be tried again naked as soon as the weather got warmer. But don't believe everything you read in the papers, particularly not the Pennsylvania Gazette. The entire episode was a fabrication invented by Ben Franklin to poke fun at the outlandish notion of yokels who believed in necromancy. Satire, he found, was often a more effective weapon against the follies of the ignorant than launching a head-on assault. Yet, well into the 18th century, witchcraft remained no laughing matter. As a 34-year-old attorney, John Adams defended John Ames of West Boxford, Massachusetts, who'd been accused of murdering his wife, Ruth. The two had been married in December of 1768 and moved together to the home of his parents. The bride was already with child, the marriage off to a bad start. The next spring, a baby was born to the couple, and shortly afterward, the young mother died under circumstances that led to neighbors' suspicions and calls for an inquest. At the hearing, the church, which doubled as the courthouse, was much thronged by a promiscuous multitude of people. After opening with a prayer, the coroners then led the crowd up to the cemetery where Ruth had been hastily buried 5 weeks before to exhume the body. Short on entertainment, gawkers pushed forward to see the grisly remains. The autopsy revealed that Ruth Ames came to her death by felony, that is to say, poison, given to her by a person or persons unknown. But her husband and his mother were the prime suspects. Both were locked up pending trial. Many years before, Mr. Ames' grandmother, Rebecca, had been convicted of witchcraft and condemned to death in Salem, where his own case was now being heard. Because there was no real evidence to convict anyone, the judge in charge decided that the issue might be settled through ordeal by touch. Based on an Old English and Scottish superstition known as beer rite, This bit of folklore held that the wounds of a corpse would begin to bleed anew if touched by the murderer. Shakespeare alludes to it in his play Richard III, when a guilty Gloucester interrupts the funeral of Henry VI, Lady Anne cries, "Oh, gentlemen, see, dead Henry's wounds open their congealed mouths and bleed afresh." The unnatural deed was supposed to excite a supernatural response from the dead body. The technique was tried and true. It had often been employed in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. In 1646, for instance, a woman named Mary Martin found herself in the age-old predicament of being pregnant and unwed. In her case, unfortunately, the father was already married. When the time came, Mary said her baby was delivered stillborn, but infanticide seemed more likely. Before a jury, the mother was commanded to touch the face of her deceased child. When she did, quote, "the blood came fresh to it," after which she made a full confession and was sentenced to be hanged. In a macabre ending, according to Governor Winthrop, after poor Mary had hung a space, she spake and asked what they did mean to do. Then some stepped up and turned the knot of the rope backward, and then she soon died. Now, over 100 years later, ordeal by touch was again being invoked to determine guilt or innocence. Ruth Ames' body was laid out on the table with a sheet over it. The accused were told to place their index fingers on the dead woman's neck. At this point, the attorney for the defense objected loudly. John Adams was aghast at the proceedings and refused to let his client touch his wife's body, declaring, "This is nothing but black arts and witchcraft." Ames was acquitted of the murder charge, and it was the last time that witchcraft wormed its way into a Massachusetts court of law. If the framers were committed to due process, building into the Constitution the right to trial by jury, protection from self-incrimination, prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment, the right to counsel and cross-examine witnesses, it was for good reason the mania of Salem was not so far in the past.
Thank you very much. That's just incredible.
It's quite a story, isn't it?
It's such a story, but also
the John Adams trying that case on the eve of the American Revolution, this period of enlightenment,
right.
Ordeal by touch.
The juxtaposition of the ignorance.
Well, of course, we still live in an age of ignorance. You know, these founders, they were just emerging from the Dark Ages. Many people in those days still believed that the Earth was at the center of the solar system.
Yeah.
And of course, vestiges of that medieval world still linger into the 21st century. A majority of Americans today tell the pollsters that they believe we were originally created in the Garden of Eden, and that the theory of evolution is just a lot of hooey, you know. So there are pre-modern people living in our day, just as there were at that time.
Mm-hmm. I know you've written books about animals and about coping with the emotions we feel when we lose a pet, and they include Goodbye, Friend, Healing Wisdom for Anyone Who Has Ever Lost a Pet, The Souls of Animals, and The Bible According to Noah, Theology as If Animals Mattered. How did this come to be an area of interest for you?
Well, I feel a deep sense of kinship with animals. And like the founders, my own spirituality is nature-based. In fact, I think there may be a bit of the pagan or the nature worshiper in all of us. Who doesn't feel a sense of awe and reverence standing out under the night sky with all the stars, or standing on the edge of the ocean and watching the surf roll? And you feel that there are powers at work that are larger than yourself, and that you may be part of a story that's older and longer than your own. That realization came to me about 20, 25 years ago. That was the first time I heard the story about Coco and her kitten.
Mm-hmm.
It's mid-80s. Coco was living at the Gorilla Foundation in Woodside, California. Coco's a female lowland gorilla, and Penny Patterson, her trainer, had been
right.
teaching her sign language. That was how Coco asked for a cat for her birthday. She enjoyed reading Puss in Boots or looking at the pictures and pointed, you know, this is what I want for my present. So she got this little cat, and the two of them bonded and were playing tickle games, and Coco named the cat All Ball for some reason. They were very close friends. And then somehow the cat was killed. It escaped from the compound and was hit by a car, and Coco was told about this. First seemed to react with shock and numbness, no real affect, no feeling, and then began to quietly sob after a few minutes. But the amazing thing was someone was able to ask Coco what she understood about what had happened. So Coco was asked, why do gorillas die? And Coco made the signs trouble and old. And someone asked Coco, where do gorillas go when they die? And Coco made the signs for comfortable, whole, like a hole in the ground, and then made the sign goodbye, kissing the lips goodbye, a gesture of farewell. Finally, Coco was asked, how do gorillas feel when they die? Are they happy or sad or afraid? And Coco made the sign for sleep. Well, this was a time when I just lost my grandfather and I was grieving, and although I'd been to divinity school, they don't teach you the answers there of why people die or where you find hope or courage to face the end. And I was struggling, and something about that story just opened up my heart, and I realized that my little piece of pain and confusion wasn't just mine, that I was really part of this much larger family of life that for millions of years had been dealing with these realities of loss and love and death and birth and healing. And it led me to a deep sense of kinship with this larger family. I'd kind of lost my grandfather, you know, that piece of my family was gone. But I realized I had this much larger family I was a part of that I could never really be separated from. And that heart awakening led to an intellectual curiosity. If I'd never thought of gorillas before struggling with the problem of death and dying the way people do, what else had I been missing? So my first book, The Souls of Animals, explored those questions. Do animals dream? Do they have a sense of art or beauty? Do they have a sense of right and wrong, a moral compass? What goes on in their imagination? It was a book that I published in 91. I think it was a little ahead of its time, but it was all based on solid science, and I think now the behaviorists are starting to catch up with it.
I think this must be such a comfort to readers who have lost pets or who have lost anyone. And I'm just wondering, do you receive a lot of correspondence from people about those books?
I do. I get letters from out of the blue. People in Georgia, you know, will call or write and tell me their pastor at their church says animals don't have souls, and they're so glad to have their sense of love and connection validated by someone who's a certified religious leader like myself. But, you know, these are truths that people know intuitively. If you love a dog or a cat or a horse, you grow close, and there's a reciprocity of feeling between you and that animal. They're not just an object, they're a subject, and there's a deep, if wordless, sharing that takes place between you, and there's a great sense of hurt and separation when the relationship ends. Mm-hmm. But just as I found healing and hope when I lost my grandfather, I think all of us can rebuild our relationships and our sense of being connected to a larger life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you ever get writer's block?
Yes, I do get writer's block. But when I'm writing history, the research is always fascinating. So I think I enjoy the research as much as the writing. And if I have writer's block, I can just go into the library or on the internet and get some more information.
Spend some time. So do you have advice for writers when they get writer's block?
Maybe like me, they need to find a day job. I do things besides write, and right. I would hate to depend on the income of my published books to make a living. You know, it's a tough business, and
yeah.
I wouldn't want to depend on my own creative juices flowing all the time to pay the mortgage.
All right. Well, thank you very much for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you.
That was a conversation with Gary Kowalski. Next week, tune in to hear an interview from the archives. Catherine Davis and I spoke in November of 2008 about her novel, The Thin Place. I should mention that the views expressed on Write the Book are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WOMMLP, its management board, or any of its affiliates. Today's Write the Book prompt is inspired by President's Day. As you look for writing ideas this week, consider one of the following quotes by some of our founding fathers. Listen to these famous words and then free write. Benjamin Franklin, he that goes a-borrowing goes a-sorrowing. Thomas Paine, if there must be trouble, let it be in my day that my child may have peace. Thomas Jefferson, where the press is free and every man able to read, all is safe. George Washington, guard against the impostures of pretended patriotism. And finally, James Madison, philosophy is common sense with big words. And if you can't remember all those, have a look at the podcast site and you'll see them all written out for you. Good luck with this exercise and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. Upcoming episodes of the show are often announced in my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. And stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby brings you the world of music at 3 o'clock.
This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Mm-hmm.